All right. So I am assuming most of you got your homework in, right? It was new last week. All right. There is going to be an assignment, a programming assignment that will be out soon. Okay, we are in the process of designing it. So we'll either hand it out later this week or early next week. You know, keep an eye out for that. Okay. The one thing to keep in mind is maybe not for the first one, but for subsequent programming assignments, we will allow you to work in groups of two. Okay? So if you know somebody that you would like to pair up with, you can actually start forming your group now. That way you know who you are going to work with and whatnot. Okay? Alright, so we'll continue our discussion from last time. We were talking about server design. There are a couple of overflow slides that I'll cover. And then we'll start chapter 4, which is communication and distributed systems. Okay. So, last time I was talking about some principles that you should keep in mind when designing servers. Okay, so in that context, when you have a server that needs to scale up to a much larger number of users, typically what you would do is you would have replication. You would run the same server process on multiple machines in order to scale the overall capacity of your system to a much larger number of users. And these would be referred to as clusters of servers. Okay, so there's a picture shown here. Okay, this is basically your multi-tier web application that we have seen earlier. Okay, here is your middle tier. This is the application tier. It's replicated on 6 machines as is shown here. That's the database tier of your web application, which is replicated here on 3 machines. Okay. Now when you have this form of replication, you still want to keep the fact that the server is running on multiple machines transparent to the user. Okay. Because what you want is the user still communicates with a single entity, and that entity basically does the rest. Okay. So if, in other words, if you actually make the presence of these replicas visible to the end user, then the end user has to figure out which replica to use in order to access that service. And you don't want to put this complexity on the end user or on the browser. You want to keep that transparent. This is a form of replication transparency that we had talked about a while back. So what you typically have is a load balancing switch that sits in front, and that switch is exports an IP address that the user sees. And the user communicates with the load balancing switch. So in other words, in this case, it's the HTTP service. All HTTP requests come to the load balancing switch. The load balancing switch then picks one of these replicas and forwards that request to that replica. And that's the replica that's going to service the request. Okay, this replica may then pick one of the database servers and do send its queries to that server and so on. Okay, if this is a user session as opposed to an individual request, a stateful session, then the switch has to actually keep state of the session. So all requests for that session must be sent to the same replica, because only one of those machines, the machine that processed the first request, has the full state for this user session. Okay? So you have to implement these algorithms in the load balancing switch to do all of this. Okay? So that's actually shown in this picture. Whatever the process I described is actually shown here. This is the client, there's a load balancing switch, and that's the server. Okay. The server is replicated, user requests come here, the switch actually forwards that request. Okay. Now there is a technique which is referred to as TCP splicing, okay, that can be used to implement this kind of an architecture. What happens in TCP splicing is there's a request that comes from the client to the switch. That's a TCP connection that's established between the client and the switch. Okay. The switch can establish its own TCP connection between itself and one of the replicas that it picks for servicing this user. So now there are two TCP connections, one that between the client and the switch, another one between the switch and the replica. Okay. And what the switch is, this load balancing switch is doing is, it's basically splicing this connection, it's gluing them together. So what that means is any data that comes on one connection is basically relayed and copied onto the other and vice versa. So from a client standpoint, it actually looks like this client is talking directly to the server. Okay? Any data that it sends here is copied by the switch onto this TCP connection. Any responses that are coming back are copied back. Okay? This is referred to as splicing. Okay? okay, gluing two connections together. You can also do what is called a TCP handoff. Okay. In this case, what happens is once you have figured out which replica to send, the TCP connection is actually handed off transparently, okay, to the server that has been chosen to service this connection. Okay. From this point on, all client communication directly goes to the server. It's as if you established the server connection initially with the switch handed it off to another server, so that server becomes a TCP endpoint. Okay. So all further communication actually directly goes to the server without the switch intervening in between. Okay. So you can use either a mechanism called splicing or a mechanism called TCP handoff to implement this replication transparently. Okay. The basic point is you want to make this transparent to the end user. Okay. Now, as you can imagine, as the load goes up, the number of replicas that you add to the system can also be increased in order to scale the system to a larger number of users and larger number of requests. That's the reason for replication. Okay. We will come back to this when we talk about the replication, when we come to the replication chapter later on in this course. Okay. But this is something to keep in mind as far as server design is concerned. So the last point about server design is the architecture. I briefly mentioned this when we talked about threading, okay, if you remember. So I said that any server has to be able to process multiple requests. Okay? So the architecture of the server could be sequential, that the server is basically sitting in a loop, user requests are coming in to a queue, and this you take the first request of the queue, process it, and then you take the next one and process it, and so on. Okay? So there is sequential processing of all of the requests. That's at one end of the spectrum. Okay? The other end, you have concurrent processing where there are multiple threads. Requests are coming in, they're forwarded to one of the worker threads, and that worker thread processes the request. So that's concurrent processing. Okay, that's at the other end of the spectrum. Okay? Now, what lies in between, as I also mentioned some time back, was this event processing, event-based processing that uses asynchronous I/O. Okay? So you can use a single thread of control through your in your server process, but that server process uses non-blocking I/O calls to service multiple concurrent requests. So in other words, it can start processing the next request even before the previous one has finished. Okay? In pure sequential processing, only one request is serviced at a time. Okay? You take the request of the head of the queue, you process, do computation, request may involve some I/O. You basically make a call for some read call or write call to some files, and then you block, okay, until the I/O request finishes. And then you finish the remainder of the processing. At that point, the request is likely done, and then you go and take the next request from the queue and process it. This is sequential processing, which involves blocking I/O calls. Okay. Asynchronous, the same sequential server can be implemented using asynchronous I/O. So in this case, you will take the first request of the queue, do some computation, and maybe it again requires you to do some I/O. Okay? So you send off a request to read a file, but you don't block. It's a non-blocking call. Okay? So you send this request off to the disk. While the disk is working, you actually go back to the queue and take the next request and start processing this and so on. Okay? At some later point, the disk would have finished processing its I/O call. It would send an interrupt back to the server process. The server process has to go take the results of the read, finish processing the request, and go back and do whatever it was, go back to what it was doing. Okay? This is called asynchronous I/O, okay? And request processing using asynchronous I/O. We refer to this as event-based servers. Okay. So you have pure sequential, you have event based, you have thread based, and there's one more category there which we haven't mentioned, that is process based. Okay. Rather than having a pool of threads, you could also have a pool of processes. Okay. There's a request coming to a process. Okay. This is the master process, and that process hands the request off to one of the worker processes. So instead of worker threads, you have worker processes. So you have this whole spectrum of architectures that you can use to design your server. So one question that you should ask is, which architecture is most efficient from a performance standpoint? And then based on that, you can make design decisions as to which of these you should pick for your programming assignment or systems that you will build in the future. Any thoughts on the efficiencies of these various architectures. Okay, so should be clear that a sequential server is not going to, pure sequential is not going to give you high throughput, because it's only processing one user request at a time. So that's out of the picture. Okay. If you compare these two, thread-based is going to be more efficient than process-based. They are doing the same thing. In one case, you have to hand a request off to a different process. In another case, you hand it to another thread within the same process. So this requires context switches, because you will basically stop executing the master process, start executing one of the worker processes. Context switches are expensive. Okay. This only requires switching between threads, much cheaper. Okay. So between these two, we know this is better. Right? And here we know that this is not going to give you good performance. Okay, so now the choice is between, of the most efficient one is going to be between event-based and thread-based. So the question is, which of these two would be better from a performance or efficiency standpoint?
Event-based.
Event-based, why is that? Okay, so you're saying if the system is idling, if it's event based, then it can start executing it, right? So true, but that is true also for the thread based. Why would the idling threads not be started up when you receive a request? Any thoughts on this whatsoever?
Event-based requires
message queuing. Okay. I think both of them require a queue, right? So in either case, there's a queue of requests. All requests join this queue. In a thread base, there are these multiple processes and requests are being farmed out. In the event base, you have the same queue. Okay? There's one thread that has actually taken on multiple requests, is processing them asynchronously, using asynchronous call. Yes, you
have to.
Yes, thread base requires more resources when you're idle, true. But that doesn't tell you what happens when you're not idle. The efficiency comes on which of these is going to service a greater number of, requests concurrently. Which one gives you greater throughput? Debugging becomes difficult, true. Event based, harder to write. But that's nothing to do with efficiency. Completely true. That these are not easy applications to write, debug, and get it right. So that's absolutely true. Which is why the threading model gives you those programming advantages. But the question is about efficiency rather than ease of programming.
You can get requests. You can receive and. You could receive requests in thread-based and process them parallelly on multiple processes. In event-based, you just have a single thread running, so that way it would be less efficient.
Right. So only in the sequential case do you have single request per at any instant. And event-based is actually servicing requests in parallel. That was the point about asynchronous communication.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we are not talking about pure sequential, that has been eliminated. Okay. So to understand efficiency, right, you have to ask where are the inefficiencies coming from? Okay, where are you doing wasted work in the application? That's what's going to tell you which of the two is more efficient. Okay. Both are able to service requests in parallel. Okay, so from that perspective, there isn't any difference. One is using asynchronous I/O, the other one is using synchronous blocking call. Okay. There is no difference. The only difference that is actually going to come up is when you are switching between requests. Okay, within for a single request doesn't look like there is any difference. So when you switch between requests, a threaded application requires you to switch between threads. Yeah, that's a thread-based context switch. an event based server doesn't need any context switch. It's basically just jumping from one function to another. It's like just jumping within the same application from one piece of code to another. Okay. So switching between requests is far more efficient in event based servers, even though it has only a single thread, okay, than in a thread based, because here it involves a context switch. I just switch between one request to another. Okay. As a result, event based systems can give you much higher throughput than thread based systems. Okay. On a single core machine, there's a catch. If you have multiple cores, then event based is not going to scale beyond the capacity of a single core. Thread based can use multiple cores in parallel. But on a single core system, an event based application is going to give you much higher throughput than thread based. So if you actually look at very specialized applications that are designed for scaling to very high throughputs, they use event based models. Okay? They are harder to write, but that extra work pays off in terms of better performance. Okay? So that's the thing to keep in mind. So most likely you will not use the event based for your systems that you build in this class at least. But something to keep in mind, that if you really want to scale on single core, that's the way to go in terms of the architectural choice. Okay? Alright, so that's basically all I have to say about server design. We are going to switch gears, move on to the next chapter. And this one is communication and distributed systems. So I'll give a quick introduction, some background about protocol stacks and whatnot. Then much of the class we will talk about RPCs and remote procedure calls. Okay? The goal here is to not just understand what's an RPC. Most of you may actually know what RPCs does, but rather our goal is to understand how to build an RPC system. You are building a distributed system, what is it that RPC system does underneath, and what are the choices that are available in terms of design space and so on. Okay? That's what we want to do. Next time we'll talk about RMIs, remote method invocations, which is basically RPCs in the object oriented world. Okay, so let's start talking about communication. Okay? So first let's talk about communication between processes that sit on the same machine. Okay, so this could be processes or threads. Okay. So there are two ways, either threads or processes on a single machine can communicate with one another. Okay. And that's using structured or unstructured communication. Unstructured communication just says you use some shared data structures to communicate. Okay. So this could be either shared memory or some other data structure. So you basically communicate by either placing a message or modifying the value of a data structure. Some other thread or process can look at whatever modifications you have made and act on it. Okay. This is one way to communicate. Okay. Structured communication involves sending messages. Okay. So you explicitly send a message to another thread or another process. Okay. That process receives that message and looks at the content of the message and does some computation. Okay. As far as communication is concerned, both of these are equivalent. Both allow you inter-process, forms of inter-process communication. Okay? Is that clear? Alright. So now we are really interested in distributed systems. So these are processes or threads that are not running on the same machine, but they are running on different machines. Okay? So you have to extend this notion to multiple machines. Okay? And to do this, you need some form of communication support. Okay. Here you did not need a network. Okay, all of the communication was local to a machine. Okay, even if the machine had no network whatsoever, you are basically just communicating using memory or messages. Okay, messages don't leave the system. Okay, but in a distributed system they will, because processes reside on different machines. Okay, so you need a network fundamentally. Okay. So that basically says you need some kind of a network protocol stack. Okay, the most common one that you use is the TCP/IP stack. And I presume all of you at least know what the protocol stack looks like. Here's a picture which shows you the 7 layers of the protocol stack. Not all are implemented in TCP. Okay. The physical layer is basically the medium that you use to communicate. The data link layer is the MAC layer that you use to communicate between the two endpoints. And then the most important ones in a distributed system, or really a network in this case, are the network protocol and the transport protocol. Network protocol is responsible for hop by hop communication. transport protocol is responsible for end-to-end communication. Okay? These two processes may reside on machines that are not directly connected by a single link. So any message that you send from one to another might go through multiple hops. Okay, these hops, so there are routers that sit in between that actually route your messages through the network, so until it gets to the destination. Okay? The network protocol, okay, or the protocol that runs at this layer is responsible for doing routing and hop by hop communication. Okay? The transport protocol runs at the two endpoints. Okay? This does things like error flow control and congestion control, and if messages get dropped in the network because there is a problem, it does retransmissions and whatnot. Okay. So the session and presentation layers, basically the session layer protocol keeps session state, the presentation protocol looks at presentation to the application, and at the application level you have an application protocol. This could be something like HTTP or FTP or SCP. This is the application itself. Right? Okay. So this is basically your protocol stack. Okay. I'm assuming that you know what a protocol stack looks like. If not, stop me and ask me questions. I'm just flashing this slide just to give you context for the remainder of the class. Is this clear? Alright. So just very quickly, what is shown on the next slide. So these are the two endpoints. Yeah, there may be multiple hops in between, and the way messages are processed by the protocol stack is the application endpoint here wants to send a message to the other application endpoint. This may be a client, that may be a server. For instance, client wants to send a message to the server. The client constructs an application level message that's packaged using the application level protocol. This could be, for instance, HTTP. So you create an HTTP message. Okay? That goes down the protocol stack. Okay, in TCP/IP, these two layers are not present. Okay? So this directly goes to the TCP layer, for instance. So the TCP layer is then going to add the TCP layer headers onto this protocol stack, onto this message, and send it down. Okay, then it comes to the network layer. So here you add IP headers. Okay, so this is the network layer headers. You send it down, and here you may be using Ethernet or Wi-Fi to communicate. So you add headers to the Ethernet frame or your 802.11 frames, and then send the message out onto the physical network. Okay, so then it comes out at the other end. Actually, if there are multiple hops, it's going to come out at each hop. And the same thing is going to repeat there. Okay, so you'll process the message in reverse. Okay, the message comes out here, so you'll take the look at the Ethernet frame, look at the Ethernet header, process the message, make sure there is no errors in the transmission, and strip those headers off, send it one layer up. And the IP protocol will take over, look at the IP header, decide what to do with it, strip the IP headers off, okay, hand it to the TCP layer, okay, or the transport layer, and so on, until it goes back to the application. That's what is shown in this slide here, okay, in a slightly different way. This is the application payload that you need to send from the client to the server or back. Okay. So here you first append the application layer header to this message, and then this is sent to the next layer. Okay, in this case, it's showing all the layers. So the presentation layer, if it's present, would add its own header, send it down the protocol stack, and so on and so forth. And when it goes out onto a physical medium, you have all of these headers and maybe footers for that matter that have gotten appended to the message. Okay, at the other end, this message comes out, so you look at this header, decide what to do with it, strip it off, give it to the higher level protocol, and so on and so forth. Okay, this is typical protocol processing in any stack, including TCP. Okay, so with that in mind, let's just look quickly at all of the messages that are exchanged between a typical client and a server for a simple request response paradigm. Okay, so let's assume it's a HTTP, you send an HTTP request a small HTML file, and you want to get the response back. Okay, what is happening underneath? Yeah, so we look at least the TCP level, not below that. Okay. So before the client can actually send its request to the server, it has to establish a TCP connection between the client and the server. Yeah, this is how, if you want to make an HTTP connection to a web server, your browser actually has to establish a TCP connection to the server. Okay. This involves what's called a TCP handshake. Okay. A TCP handshake involves exchanging of three messages. These are called SYN messages in order to establish a bidirectional channel so that the client can send data to the server and the server can send data to the client. So this is the verse as follows. So you basically send a SYN request to the server saying, I want to establish a connection. Okay? The server sends an acknowledgement back saying, fine. And it also sends a SYN request back to the client saying, I want to establish a connection in the reverse direction. Each SYN request sets up a unidirectional channel of communication. Okay? So this SYN request comes back saying, this, you want to establish a connection going that way. The client sends an ACK for the SYN saying, fine. At this point, after these three messages have been exchanged, there is a TCP connection that has been established between the client and the server. Okay. Now you can actually send any messages to the server and the server can send you responses. So in a typical case, you have a request message. This may be your HTTP request that goes out as the next message. Okay. And then you send a FIN saying, I am done. FIN basically tears down the connection. Along this path. So basically, the client has sent his request, it has nothing else to send, so it sent a FIN. Okay. The server can send an ACK to the request and the FIN saying, I have received your request and I have received your FIN. Okay. The connection in the reverse direction is still active. Okay. No FIN has gone there. So the server is going to then process the request at this point. Okay. Generate a response, okay. Sends a response. Then sends a FIN saying, I am done sending. Okay. And then the client is going to send an acknowledgement to the FIN saying, yes, the connection has been torn down. At this point, the TCP connection is torn down. Okay. So to send a single request and get a single response, which are just two messages, okay, you have all of these messages, nine messages going back and forth between the client and the server. If the client and the server are on the internet, which is typically the case, each of these messages has to go over a wide area network. So that's a lot of communication for a single request and a single response. Something to keep in mind. There are some optimizations that have been proposed. There's one that's shown here. Okay. This is called a transactional TCP. What it does is it optimizes this message exchange by batching multiple messages into a single message that actually goes out on the network. Okay. Now this is just a hypothetical example. There is no real system that has implemented this. This is an example to show you how TCP can be optimized for request response paradigms. Okay. Some TCP connections may be long lived, in which case you basically send multiple messages in each direction. In this case, this is a short lived connection. You are setting up the whole connection to send one message and get one response. That is optimizing it by sending the first message saying a SYN, I want to establish a connection, here's a request and I'm done. Okay. All these three actually go in one message to the server. The server knows that a connection was established, the request has already been piggybacked onto that message, and then the connection is also torn down with the same message. Okay. So these three things go out as one, and then the server can actually do its computation and send a SYN back, saying I want to establish a connection in the reverse direction, okay. Sends an acknowledgement to all of the stuff that came back, okay. Sends the response and also the FIN. Everything comes in one message back to the client. Okay. Then all the client has to do is send an acknowledgement saying, yes, I received everything, connection has been torn down. So you can reduce these nine messages down to three for this special case where you have this short-lived connection for which you send one request and receive one reply. Okay, so again, keep in mind that TCP doesn't actually do this, it does this. Okay, that's just a proposal of how to optimize it, not been implemented. Okay, so the last thing I'll talk about here is middleware protocols. Okay, so although TCP does not have presentation layer and session layers, okay, if you implement a middleware, okay, this middleware is going to sit on top of TCP and below the application and implement some other useful services for the application. So if you have things like MPI, for example, okay, this allows you to write parallel applications with very efficient message passing. Okay, we'll come to MPI detail later on in this course. But that's a middleware that uses TCP and provides a useful higher level abstraction to the application. So you use that programming abstraction for communication rather than using vanilla TCP sockets. Okay. RPCs and RMIs are example of another middleware. Okay. They sit basically between TCP/IP and what is written by the application programmer. That's a layer that sits in between and provides some other useful abstraction to the applications. So there will be this middleware protocol that will sit between vanilla TCP and the application so that you don't always program at raw socket level, which can be very painful. So you want some other libraries or some other middleware to do some of the lower, take care of the some of the lower level details, provide higher level abstractions to you. The main one abstraction that we are going to study today is that of remote procedure calls. Yeah, there will be many others that we will look at in the through the duration of this class or course rather. So before I start talking about RPC, there's one more thing I want to mention about clients and servers. And that is the architecture that you can choose to design your client and server. Because what we have talked about as a traditional client-server paradigm is also referred to as the client-pull architecture. What this means is the client sends off a request to the server and pulls a response from the server. Okay, so client has to initiate some computation at the server by sending a request and get the response it wants. There's another architecture called the server push architecture in which the server takes the initiative and starts sending data to clients without explicit client requests. This is useful for most vanilla client server applications. This is useful for certain scenarios. Video streaming is a good example. Stock tickers, if you get a stock ticker app where you get this streaming stock code that are just going across your desktop screen, that's another example of a server push architecture. In both of these scenarios, what happens is the client sets up an initial connection with the server saying either play this audio file or stream this video file to me or start streaming stock codes. Beyond this, the client does not do anything. It just sits and listens. And the server keeps sending data to the client without explicit client requests. So in the case of a video stream, the server is just going to start streaming the video. Data keeps arriving at the client. Client is not saying send me the next part of the file and whatnot. Data is just flowing over the network and arriving at a socket. The client just reads from the socket and processes the video and displays it or looks at the stock codes that have arrived and starts displaying it. It's a very different architecture than the client pull architecture. The client pull architecture, you have to explicitly tell the server what to do or what request you wanted to process, and only then the server does something. In this case, the server is asynchronously sending stuff to you without explicit request. Two modes, some are more suitable for certain applications than the other. The only thing to keep in mind are these pros and cons. Client pull architectures can be designed in a stateless fashion, and failures are easy to handle, but they may actually have less scalability than the server push architecture. I'll say why in just a moment. The server push architecture, in contrast, is stateful. You need to know which clients have requested what. So if it's a video streaming server, you need to know which clients have actually requested which movies, and you are streaming this movie over a network. So you are keeping state about the client. Which movie was requested, what's the IP address of the client, what part of the movie have you played it through, so you can start sending the next piece of the movie or the network. So it is stateful. This doesn't have to be. Now, server push architectures are fundamentally somewhat more scalable than client pull because there are fewer messages exchanged between the client and the server. Here, for every piece of data you want to request, you have to send a request and get back a reply. Two messages. Here, you only send the initial request and the data is coming to you without any additional request. That reduces the burden of extra message processing at the server end and can enhance scalability. That said, so server push architecture is less resilient to failures. The client pull architecture, because it's stateless, is also tolerant to failures. If a streaming server goes down, all the clients that were connected to the server, they were watching movies, all these clients freeze because no data arrives over the network. And when the client the server restarts, all of the previous state is lost because it was kept in memory. If the server crashes, memory state disappears. So, as a result, the server push architecture is less tolerant to failures, because the state that you keep in memory goes away if the process crashes. If you checkpoint the state on disk, that's a different problem. And then you can recover that state after a crash, but that's additional work the server has to do. Okay? So, that's the server push and the client pull architecture. Okay, again, for the purposes of this class, you may probably design your application or system using client pull. But keep in mind that there's other architectures as well. Okay, so I'm going to skip group communication for now. We'll come back to it later. Let me start talking about remote procedure calls. Okay. So what I'm going to do is basically talk about what is an RPC or a remote procedure call. Okay. And then we'll talk about how remote services can be invoked or written using the notion of an RPC, and then what are issues that arise in the design of an RPC system. That's really what we are interested in, but to get here we have to first start with the background. Okay, what is RPC and how it works and so on. Okay. So to understand remote procedure call, let's start with conventional procedure calls first. Okay. So here is a program that's executing. Okay. In memory, this is the stack of the program. You should all know what a stack is, right? That's a piece of memory that keeps track of the local variables and the current context and whatnot. Okay? That's a stack pointer. When this program makes a function call, okay, some additional stuff gets pushed onto the stack. In particular, the return address of the function that made the call is put in the parameters that are passed to the function calls are pushed onto the stack. And there are some, so those are all of the parameters. Okay. And these are the local variables for the function. Okay. These are the parameters, return address, local variable. All of this gets pushed. If this function makes another call, then this more stuff gets pushed out. Okay. And when functions return, this part of the stack is popped. Okay. That's how any sequentially executing program works. Okay. So what happens is basically whenever you make a function call, you jump to the code where this function resides in memory and start executing that. The function returns, you jump back. Okay, and then what the results of that function are returned back to you via return value. And anything you wanted to pass to the function are passed through parameters. Okay, this is how functions will interact with one another. Okay. Now in a remote, the notion of a remote procedure call is very similar to a conventional procedure, except that the function you are calling is a piece of code that resides on some other machine, is not a function that resides within the address space of the current process. Okay, is that clear what I just said? So a remote procedure call is basically like invoking a procedure, but a procedure that resides in some other process on some other machine, not a procedure that's local to the current process. Okay, that is basically what a remote procedure call does. Okay. And there are many, so think of what that means. So let's start. Okay, this is main. So this is a C program. Okay, so this is a program and you call foo with some variable. Okay. So if this program is executed, this is a conventional procedure, when you execute this statement, you will basically, the main will jump or transfer control to foo, will execute, and once it's done, you will return back with some return value. Okay? Conventional procedure. So now let's assume the same main program, it calls foo, but foo is actually processed on some other machine. So in an RPC, what would happen is you will actually send a message to that process saying, I want to execute foo, send all the parameters over, okay, to this process. This process receives this message and it actually executes the procedure with the parameters that were passed, computes a return value, and sends the return value back as a message back to foo. Okay. That's what a remote procedure call does for you. Now, if this was a client and this is a server, you can invoke services at the server by simply making function calls. Okay. what is important or why this is actually a powerful abstraction is from an application programmer standpoint, this is the code you actually write. Okay? Even though this function actually resides on some different machine, you have not specified anything here. You haven't specified what is the IP address of the machine. You haven't specified any message passing. You are just making a function call from as an application programmer. Underneath, something is happening that triggers this message, invokes the execution of that procedure on some other machine, gets back the result, and delivers that result back to you as if you had made a local function call. Okay? So from a programmer perspective, remote procedure calls look exactly like local procedure calls. Okay, so you don't actually deal with all the details of trying to understand where, how to set up a connection to the server, how to send this message. All of that is taken care for you. Okay, in this case, it's taken care by the RPC system. Okay. So if you think about it, this is a very elegant way of writing distributed applications. Okay. You just figure out what functionality resides on the server and implement them as some function calls. Okay. And then clients can invoke that functionality by making simple procedure calls within their application. And this triggers communication between the client and the server. All done transparently. Okay. In contrast, if you are actually writing your own client-server application from scratch, at the beginning of this main program, you would have to set up a socket connection. Okay? Then you would basically, when time comes to communicate, you have to construct a message. You have to send it on the socket connection. It has to go to the server. You have to wait for the reply. And once the reply comes, you process the reply and do something with it. All of that code you have to write. In the RPC system, this is all transparent. You don't have to worry about it. All of those things still happen, but transparent. You don't write that code. That code is automatically generated for you by the RPC system. Okay, is that clear? Okay. So that's the notion of a remote procedure call and what it does for you. Okay, and the basic point is it allows you to write distributed applications using the same abstractions you are always used to, which is just partitioning the functionality of your app into functions and making function calls, except that it so happens that some of these functions reside on different machines. Okay. Now, there are some important differences between making a local procedure call and making a remote procedure call, and this has to really do with sending the parameter and getting replies back from the function. Okay. Typically, in any programming language, if you make a function call, you are either going to pass these parameters by value or by reference. Okay. If the functions of the parameters of the function rather are sent by value, then you make a copy of these parameters and you hand over the copy to the function. Okay? The function can modify these values, but the original values are not modified. That's call by value. Okay? If you call by reference, which is equivalent to sending pointers, okay, or using references in Java, then you basically don't make a copy. You actually hand over a reference to the original parameters. So if the called function modifies them, the parameters actually get modified in the parent as well. Okay? So you have call by value, call by reference when you do local procedure call. Now you cannot do this when you are remote procedure calls. Okay? Because this call function is actually residing on some other machine. Okay? Fundamentally, any parameter you pass has actually been copied into a buffer and sent over. So if this function actually modifies that parameter, that's not going to get reflected here because it's executing in on a different machine, different address space. Is that clear? So one issue that you have to keep in mind is when you use RPCs, most of your applications or functions have to be written assuming call by value, because typically call by reference is not going to be supported by the RPC system. A call by reference requires that when this function modifies this int I, that modification get reflected. That's much harder to do. It can be done. When we talk about RMIs, we'll see how to relax this assumption. But for the purposes of RPCs, we will assume that you can only write functions that are call by value, especially remote procedures. Okay. So this is one issue. So here we have just passed a simple integer. Okay, now think about, you have int, okay, and then you call foo, and you pass the array. Okay? Or you might have a complex data structure which is a struct, and I pass the struct, and struct could be fairly large. Okay? So, as we know, any for function call is going to deal with it. If it's called by value, to make a copy of this and hand it to the function, hand it to the call function. If it's called by reference, then you will basically pass a pointer to this data structure to the call function, and it can modify it. Okay? In RPCs, there's no call by reference, there's only call by value, but you still have to deal with this issue of taking this large data structure that is being passed as a parameter, make a copy of it and send it over. Okay? And these parameters could be of arbitrary sizes, there is no restriction. I could pass an array with 100,000 entries, and the RPC system will have to do all of the work of making a copy of it, sending lots of messages with all of this data, and then have it appear at the other end. So that is what your RPC system has to do. Now the piece of code that is actually running here at the client end, and for that matter at the server end, that makes all of this communication between the client and the server possible, is called a stub. Okay, typically there's a client stub and a server stub. Okay? And this actually does all of the hard work. The first time you actually make an RPC call, it has to first track down the server. It has to know where is the server running in the system. It may do a directory lookup. Okay, once it has tracked the server down, it has to establish a TCP connection with the server. Okay? And then it has to take this function, okay, construct a message, take all of the parameters that were passed, make local copies of them, make a buffer, send the whole thing over. Okay? And then it will arrive at this stub, that stub is going to then actually invoke the function for you with those parameters. Okay? Here it's a local function call from the stub to the function itself, process it, get the reply back, construct a message with the reply, send it back. All of this is actually being done by this piece of code called a stub. Okay? Stubs are automatically generated for you by the RPC compiler. Okay, all you have to do is link it to your application and everything is taken care of. Okay. Now, one extra thing work that the stub does is what is called marshalling of arguments or flattening of arguments. Okay. So there are some important details that I glossed over in this simplified description of communication between the client and the server. The first is we didn't make any assumptions about where the client was running and where the server was running. Okay. RPC system allow heterogeneity between the client and the server. Okay. Server could be running on Windows, client could be running on Linux. This could be Spark architecture, that could be Intel architecture. Okay. So in other words, the client and the server can run on heterogeneous systems, where both the hardware platform as well as the OS is different. Nevertheless, the RPC system should work as is, okay, without any changes. To do this, you have to actually deal with any of the hardware and software differences. Okay? The main difference comes in hardware. So for instance, if this is a little Indian architecture and this is a big Indian architecture, you are sending an int over. Okay? Int is just a set of bits. Okay? There could be 32 bits. How should the server interpret it? Okay, that's just a message. Some bits have come over a network. How do you read it from the left or from the right? Okay. So there has to be a common language so that regardless of these hardware differences, an int is an int, regardless of whether your server is little Indian or big Indian. Okay. So typically what the stub will do is it will translate all of your data into an external format that is agreed to by any implementation of this RPC system. It's called XDR format, external data representation. So you translate integer, data structures, everything is translated into this XDR format, it's sent over, and the server end is translated back to your hardware format. Okay. And because this XDR format is predetermined, anything that is written to an XDR format can then be translated back. You know how to interpret integers, you know how to interpret arrays, data structures, all of that is specified. Okay. So you have to do this extra work, otherwise your system will not work across hardware heterogeneity. It will only work if all of the machines are identical. Is this clear?
Doesn't the IDL do that as well?
Yes, so that we'll talk, that's what the compiler is going to do for you. Or compiler will generate code that will do it for you. Yes. Okay. So here is the simplified scenario of how RPCs work. Okay, this is the client application, that's the server application. Black lines in say sort of indicate computation, dotted lines indicate blocking or waiting. Okay. So the client does some computation. At this point it makes an RPC and it's going to block, it's going to wait for this function, remote function to return. Okay, so that the stub is then going to construct this message, send it over, okay, marshal all the arguments. And then you do the computation, reply comes back, okay, and the client continues. Okay, so calls are all blocking, function calls are blocking, even in conventional procedure calls, that's the way it works. Okay. So this is the picture in mind. We will come and look at other variants of RPCs. This is just standard blocking RPCs. There are things called asynchronous RPCs. We'll come back to them next time. Okay, not today. Okay, so now let's look at stubs in a little more detail. Okay, so the client makes a procedure call. We know this. Server is written as a procedure, a set of procedures that it has exported. We know that also. So what's the stub doing? It's taking care of packaging of arguments, sending messages. Okay, and this process is called marshalling. So as was mentioned here, you have basically a language that you write the spec for your RPC in. Okay, you have to specify to the compiler which functions are really remote procedures and which ones are not. Okay, so it will take all the remote procedure and it uses this interface definition language and will generate a stub for you. Okay, this tells it what the function looks like. Okay, what are the arguments, what are the return values going to look like. So using that it's going to construct some stub code so that you can make this RPC. So these are all the steps. I already talked about this. Okay, I'm not going to go through this in detail. Basic point is the stub is going to construct a message, send it over to the server. Server is going to unpack that message, process it, construct a reply message, send it back, unpack, and send hand deliver to the application. Okay, this is showing the same set of steps pictorially. Okay, easier to understand. So here is add ij. That's a server with an implementation of the add function. So when you make this call, you will actually go into a stub. Okay, this add is implemented as a stub procedure here. So in this stub procedure, you will construct a message. It says the function you are calling is add. There are two arguments, both are integers. This is the value of I that was passed, this is the value of j that was passed. This is a message sent over a network, appears here. Okay, then the stub unpacks this message saying the client is requesting that the server execute the function add. It has sent two integers. These are the values of those two integers. So then it actually calls add ij with these two parameters. Okay. Then it add actually results the returns the result. In the reverse, you basically construct a message with the reply and send back. Okay. So I talked about the need to handle differences in hardware formats, specifically if you have little Indian and big Indian and your client and servers are executing on different machines, you have to have a stub that can deal with it. Okay, so this is, as I already mentioned, uses external data representation. So in this step here, when you say this is the value of I and this is the value of J, you specify the value of I in XDR format. XDR format is just a format where you have a priori determined that any message that you send over a network will be little Indian, just as an example. So if you are big Indian architecture, you have to flip the bits and send the message in little Indian format. Can everybody agree that all messages are coming in little Indian regardless of what you are as a machine? Okay. So when the message comes, you have to then translate it back to your native format. Okay. That is where this translation takes place. Okay. That's one thing you have to do. The other thing you have to do is what is called flattening. Okay. Flattening just says if you have complex data structure, this is the order in which you send out this data structure. So the simplest example is you have a two-dimensional array. Okay. So how will you actually take this two-dimensional array and pack into messages? Are you going to go row first or are you going to go column first? Okay, you have to specify this so that the other end can take this message and then reconstruct the array. If you don't know the order in which you have packed, you cannot unpack. Okay. marshalling or flattening actually determines or specifies in what order you will actually take all this complex data structure, construct a linear sequence of bytes, which is the buffer or sort of the message that you send over a network. And then you know how to unpack that and sort of reconstruct that data structure at the other end. So just a set of rules that say, if you have these kinds of data structure, this is the order in which you should pack them and unpack them. Okay, is that clear? Okay. So, one question is, can you pass pointers, or if so, what are you going to do? Okay. Typically, as I mentioned, you do not want to support pass by reference. Okay. So, if you take a pointer and you pass it, okay, there are going to be problems at the other end. Okay. So, what you know what a pointer is. So, let's suppose you have int I or int star I. And you did a malloc for I, and an I is basically a piece of memory that's on your heap. Okay. If you pass I as a parameter, if you say foo and I, so what happens is this function actually gets the address where this I resides. Okay. And when you dereference this address, you get access to the value that is that you're stored in I. Now, if you pass a pointer over a network, what has come at the other end is just the address where I resides here in the calling process. This address makes no sense in the context of that address space. Okay, it's just an address. Okay, dereferencing it will actually cause you to look at the address here, which is not the same as what was stored here. Okay. So, if you pass pointers, the pointers have no meaning at the other end. Okay, because pointers are merely memory addresses on the calling machine, or in the calling process rather, not even in the calling machine. Okay. So typically, to avoid this problem in an RPC system, you shouldn't pass pointers. In fact, the compiler will throw an error if you try to construct an RPC call or write an RPC with pointers in it, because it doesn't support it. Okay. So many RPC systems will take the first approach, which is prohibit use of pointers within RPCs altogether. Okay. There are some RPC systems that can relax this assumption. What they do is they will basically take the local pointer and make it into what is called a network pointer. Okay. So network pointers you can chase network pointers across a network. Okay. So if think of a network pointer. Local pointer is basically a memory address. A network pointer can be an IP address, a process ID, and a memory address within that process. That could be a representation of the network process address. So if you dereference this network address, or rather network pointer, to do a lookup on this pointer, you have to actually send a message back to this machine and that process saying, I want to look up this memory content. What is its value? Okay. So if you actually support this notion of a network pointer, then dereferencing the network pointer involves message passing. Okay, because you are actually saying, I want to look at that memory location. And the only way to do is send a message back specifying what you want to look up, and then the results come back to you. Okay, clearly, this is not efficient. A memory lookup has actually turned into a network message. The whole reason to have pointers was you can actually make efficient use of memory. Okay. Now, if you are going to send messages back and forth to do memory lookups, performance is going to suffer. Okay. But it does allow you flexibility within your RPC system. Okay. When we come to RMIs, we will see that you are actually allowed to pass by reference, and this is essentially what you are going to do. You are going to chase or when you dereference, you are actually going to have to go over a network to figure out what the object was or what values it's stored in fields in the object. Okay, so that's pointers. Okay, so there's one more thing that the stub has to do, which I basically again glossed over, which is how is the client going to locate the server in order to establish this TCP connection. Okay, in the RPC call, you have not specified any IP address or subport number, nothing has been specified, just making a function call with some parameters. The stub has to actually figure out where is the server that is actually going to export this procedure. What's the IP address, what's the port number, and set up a connection. Okay. The programmer hasn't specified it. So how is the RPC system going to find it out? So you basically use a directory service. It's called a binder in RPC terminology. So what happens is when you start the server up first time, it goes and registers itself with this service called a binder. It says, I am a server. This is the interface I am exporting. Interface could say, I am going to export a function called foo. So if somebody wants to access this function, then basically tell them my IP or the IP address of this machine and this port number. So you register yourself with your interface, okay, at any server initialization time. Okay. And you have some unique identifiers to make sure if there are two services, both have function foo, you don't get confused. Okay. So in the client, on the client side, the first time you make an RPC, you are going to do this directory lookup, saying where is the server that has implemented this RPC, rather this interface of this function foo. Thus the directory service will tell you this server is running on this machine, this is the port number. Okay. And the stub is actually going to go and set up a connection. Okay. And now all of this has actually been done transparently. This is still the code you will write. All of this work is happening here. This is automatically generated code by the compiler. Is that clear how this works? Okay, so the thing to keep in mind is exporting this interface and importing it at the other end is going to incur some overheads. Okay? But this overhead comes, or you pay this overhead in order to gain flexibility by hiding a lot of the details from the application program. Okay? So essentially RPC system sort of expose a certain level of transparency about where the server is running, what IP address, all of this is transparent to you. You don't need to deal with all of those details, so which is why writing applications using RPCs is much easier. Okay. The other thing that I sort of didn't mention is this directory service can also do load balancing. Okay. If you have multiple replicas of the server that all implement the same function foo, they can all register with the directory service. And if there are lots of clients trying to access this service or call this function foo, you can redirect each request to a different server. Okay, at initial bind time, once you bind to a server, you can't change that binding. And the client start up, each client is basically pointed to a different server, and then you can balance the load across these servers. Okay. So there are a few things to keep in mind when you write an RPC system, and these have to actually deal with failures at both ends. Okay, and so what kind of failure semantics should you implement in your RPC system? So there are various kinds of errors that can occur. First one is client is unable to locate the server. Okay. You made an RPC call, server is not running. Okay, it never started up or it has crashed. Okay, clearly an error, system cannot continue. So you just have to return an error to the client. So in this case, this foo call is going to fail and it's going to get an error value. Okay, saying that there is no server. There are other issues that can occur. The messages that the stub is sending to the server end and replies, these could get lost. Okay. Now they can get lost if you are actually using a protocol such as UDP that is not going to give you all these benefits that TCP gives you. TCP will recover lost messages recover from lost messages by retransmitting a message. Okay. It's not necessary that the RPC system use TCP as its transport protocol. There are RPC systems. In fact, the original RPC system was built on top of UDP for efficiency reasons. Okay. Now, UDP is basically going to give you no error recovery whatsoever. Okay. So, all error recovery has to be handled at the application layer. So, if this stub sends a message off to the server, never hears back from the server because message never reached the server, what should the stub do? Okay. Or if the stub sent a message and the reply came back but the reply never reached the client, what should happen? Okay. Now you can get around all of this problem by running the RPC system on top of TCP, in which case you don't need to deal with this issue because the transport protocol is going to deal with it, and you basically get abstraction of a reliable channel, which means the channel doesn't lose messages for you. But if you happen to use a protocol that is not reliable, it's unreliable transport protocol, then the stub has to handle it all of these issues. Okay. So here are what, here are things you could do. And the same thing your TCP would do essentially. If you have lost request messages, you have timeout mechanisms. You send out a request, you start a timer. If you don't hear within a certain time period, you resend. Assume that the message didn't reach the server and whatnot. Okay. The choice of the timeout value is going to be important. Okay. Because there's a trade-off between responsiveness and doing extra work. So if you set the timeout to be too small, and the server just happens to be overloaded, your message didn't get lost, but the server is overloaded and as a result is slow, then you are actually sending messages again and again asking the server to do process this procedure call for no reason. Okay. On the other hand, if you set the timeout to be very large, and if the message actually gets lost, the client is going to block for a long period of time. Okay, it could have retransmitted the request, gotten a reply and continued execution. You are going to block until you get back the results. Okay. So you have to choose this carefully to strike a good balance between not sending wasteful messages to the server and also not making the client block for long periods of time. Okay. And the last reply is the same thing. There may be timeout mechanisms and you can actually send replies. Okay, the important thing to keep in mind is although you are actually sending replies, requests and retransmitting requests and replies, you want to make sure that if the server is stateful in any way, re-executing a procedure does not cause problems. Okay, in other words, you want to make your remote procedure call operation idempotent. Okay, reason is as follows. So let's suppose this server is basically a counter. Okay, and it basically has a local variable which is count. So let's suppose you are counting some number of events. Every time an event occurs anywhere in the system, the client sends a message to the server saying count, and it increments the count by one. Okay, and sends back a reply saying success. This is your remote procedure call. This is a stateful server because it's keeping track of the total number of events that have occurred in the system. Okay. Now consider the scenario where an event occurred at the client. Clients basically invoked that RPC to increment the counter by one. Okay. Suppose that the request actually reached the server. It incremented the counter and the reply value which said success was lost. The client stub times out saying I never received the reply value and resends this request saying execute count again. What is going to happen? You have one event, but you resend this, make this RPC twice, okay, and the count is going to be incorrect because it's going to increment it yet again. Okay, this is a global variable, it's just incrementing every time somebody makes an RPC. So you make it twice, you'll increment it twice. So you get incorrect results. Okay. This is a very trivial example, but think of this as a banking system. Right? You are making a deposit into a bank account electronically using an RPC system. You sent a request saying add $1,000 to this bank account. Okay. And if the reply got lost and you resend that, and now you're in your database you have an incorrect result because you incremented the bank balance twice instead of once. So you can have all sorts of problems in real applications if you don't deal with this problem. So as I said, the way to get around it is use TCP. So you don't deal with it at the application level. TCP is going to retransmit. Application just see a reliable channel. Whatever is sent here comes out there. Okay, you don't deal with it. Okay? But if you do have to deal with it, then you have to make the request idempotent. You don't want to re-execute requests that are already executed. Okay? When we do a case study of Sun RPC, we will see how this works. Essentially what happens is when you make a request to the server, you add a unique ID. Okay, think of this as a transaction ID or the function invocation number. Okay. So the server then keeps track of which unique ID RPCs have already been executed. Okay. So if the client resends this request because it did not hear the reply, this will go back to the server. The server will see it has already executed this before. Okay, so this is merely a retransmit, and if it actually caches the return value, you can actually send the return value without re-executing the request. Because all that has happened is the function has executed, you computed the reply already, you just cached it. So if this request comes back and you know that you executed this function in the past, just do a lookup of the reply and send back the reply without re-executing. So this is how the system can make the function idempotent, even though it may not be. Okay, or you have to design your application so that everything is idempotent. So there are only two choices. The RPC system does something for you by caching results so you don't re-execute unnecessarily. Okay? Or you write your application so that this property is true. Then the RPC system doesn't have to provide you any extra features. Okay, so we talked about client is unable to locate the server. What happens when request messages are lost? What happens when the reply messages are lost? And now there is this issue of what happens if the server fails during an operation. Okay. So in this case, the network is not the issue. The RPC message came over to the server. The server has crashed while it was executing the RPC request. Okay, the process crashed. Okay, what should the RPC system do? Clearly, when the process recovers, you want to re-execute, okay, somehow. But what semantics should the RPC system provide to you? Okay, so there are many semantics here. Okay, the semantics basically says, if you get a reply back from the server, what can you assume happened at the server? Okay, at least one semantics says that if a reply comes back, it's guaranteed that this RPC was executed at least once. At most, one semantic says that if you actually get back a reply from the server, it's guaranteed that this RPC executed at most once. Exactly once says that if you get back a reply, you're guaranteed it executed exactly once. Okay, or you could have no guarantee at all. Clearly, this is the right semantics you want. If you get back a reply, you want to know that the procedure that you invoked once was executed exactly once. Okay. At most, at least one says you could have executed multiple times. Okay, so I retransmitted the request. The server procedure executed for a second time, regenerated the same reply, sent something back. Okay, so multiple executions are possible here. Here you have either zero or one execution. If you don't get an error message, you get a valid reply, then this is basically says it executed once. If you get an error message, you know that it executed zero times. Okay? Exactly once is actually hard to achieve. This is the most desirable, but because that requires that you make things idempotent and what. Okay, so those are server failures. The last one is actually client failures. I'm going to just introduce this. We'll come back to this. Here the situation is reversed. Client made an RPC call, server is computing the function call, and the client crashes. Okay, what happens to the reply? That's basically what is being said there. In particular, the problem, you could just discard the reply. Okay, that's a simple thing to do. But there may be scenarios where this function call may be a long running function. Okay, you basically make a request and this function call, let's say, takes 10 minutes to execute. Okay? And the client crashes immediately after making the request. Should the server continue to execute for 10 minutes when it knows that there is no client to receive this reply? What do you do? Or how do you keep track that the client is still alive and this computation is worth pursuing? If your RPC is a long running computation, you want to make sure that there is a client still alive at the other end to receive your reply. Otherwise, there is no point in continuing this computation and wasting cycles at the server. Okay. So the semantics you will provide to the server, so the RPC system, in this scenario, there are some interesting things we will talk about next time. But that's what you will do. This is how you can deal with crashes at the client. Okay. So we dealt with server crashes, we dealt with network messages getting lost. This is the last thing. So we will come back to this because we run out of time today. So let's stop here.